As you take your seats, we want to make sure your cell phones are turned off. Our next session, Managing Your Company's Most Valuable Resource, is a panel of human resource experts who will be providing best practices information regarding employee hiring and retention, employer-employee communication, managing workers' compensation costs, and much more. Acting as panel moderator is the Human Resources Director for Georgia's Effingham County Board of Commissioners, Rush Hudzinski. Please welcome Rush Hudzinski.
Good morning. I know we're getting everyone back in the door. Human resources, right out of the gate at 10:15. Who's excited about that topic? Well, I promise I'm going to tell you a few things about how we're going to relate it back to what you need. As everyone says, your cell phones would be off, and that would be very, very kind for our presenters. And quite quickly, why do we focus on human resources? The day of the personnel manager is gone. What they used to do for you and what human resources needs to do for you now has evolved into an amazing process. What I want you to think about today and what you will find is that not only am I a director of human resources in a generalist way, but I'm also the president of the Society of Human Resource Management. Your panel today only has two HR professionals in it. The reason being is that we work with other professionals due to the fact this is what we have to bring to our companies and organizations every single day. So as we go through, think of your HR department, and if you don't have one, you might want to start creating one, as being your strategic partner on the higher level. We do bring a return on investment. We know how to save money. How many of you have heard something called Obamacare? Maybe someone might want to know how to work with that so your company isn't spending as much as they thought. Liability protection. Ever heard of something called the Department of Labor, the EEOC? They have big fines. OSHA? Yes. Recruitment. Do you know how to advertise for your jobs and get in great people without spending very much in ads? Do you have the correct policies, and are they reflecting what needs to happen with the new federal laws? Just as a tidbit, over the last few years, you've had over 37 changes on the federal level alone. Benefits administration, training and development, and looking at your human resources office as a savings and profit center is key. Each day, I'm challenged to be that strategic partner and to bring about as much savings as I can so I can have as many employees as I can, so I can have them as benefited and as happy as I can, and that's a very big challenge. Today, I'd like to welcome my panel for you. We're going to be opening up with Sherry Sale. She's a senior professional in human resources. And then we're going to move into emergency management. We have Director of Emergency Management, Edwin Myrick. We will follow up by partner for Hunter McLean, and that's Wade Herring. And I also have the Employee Benefits Council from Hunter McLean, Rebecca Schapansky, and with her partner in crime, as I say, Ms. Jenny Nichols. She's a certified financial advisor and an accredited investment fiduciary. All of them are my partners on a daily basis, and I certainly hope you enjoy the information that they have. Are you ready? All right, Ms. Sherry Sale.
Okay. Good morning, good morning. I don't even need a microphone, do I? First of all, welcome to Savannah, and it's good to see you all here to hear about the different topics that we have to do. You're going to get a Reader's Digest version from all of us. Let me see here. Uh-oh, back it up. All right. And I promise you, Robert and I did not collaborate on this, but I am talking today about employee engagement. Does anybody out here have any ideas of what I'm speaking about when I say employee engagement? Got some ideas about what that might be? Okay, well, what about mutual commitment? Mutual commitment between the employees and the company, does that sound like something? Or does it look something like this? How many of you seen this movie, The Internship? Was that a great movie or what? That was really fun. But what do we see here? Here are some grown people sitting around in beanie caps, and they're trying to get just into an internship. They have a belief and a mutual commitment to being part of this team. It is exciting. They want to be part of that team. And this is what I'd like for you to try to achieve in your company. And like I said, what is employee engagement? And there's more than one definition. It is the mutual commitment between the company and the employee. And again, I thought I'd throw in another slide about that, the internship. That was a great movie. And if you haven't seen it, you do need to see it. Okay, so what does an engaged employee look like? Do any of you think you have some engaged employees in your company? Or are they just satisfied? Okay, that's two different looks. And let's examine that. Satisfied employees are there to get. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Can you hear me well? And engaged employees are there to give. Let's talk about two different experiences. Have you ever gone for a Big Mac? Whatever. But how about going for a Chick-fil-A? There's a whole different experience. A pleasure to see you at the window. That's an engaged employee. Satisfied employee, they're there to do their job. But an engaged employee will do their job above and beyond. Okay, satisfied employees, they're there about making themselves successful. And engaged employees make themselves successful and the company successful. And Mr. Robert was talking about, like, how do you get your ideas and your innovation? Well, you can't do it alone. Okay? And here is another definition. Employee engagement can also be defined as unlocking employee potential to drive high performance. It's like giving them the freedom to go ahead and be the best employee that they can be. You remember Mr. Robert talked about don't punish people for their ideas or for failure. That's exactly right, because you do learn from it. And if you give them the permission to have ideas and innovation, it's no telling where you can go with that. Okay, and employee engagement can also be defined as the capturing of discretionary effort. That going the extra mile, taking something through to its top conclusion. Okay, what about some companies? Have any of you ever flown Southwest? Good experience, right? I'm not going to say about the other ones, okay? Not going to say about the other experiences there. But they have a culture that they have cultivated where employees take ownership and they make service and the travel experience their own. How about T-Mobile? Bet you weren't aware about their company culture. They have a very fun environment. They challenge their employees to come up with new ideas and ways to do it. They've made some recent changes. They no longer sell phone equipment. They'll take whatever you get, but they give you the best value and the best service and try to give you the best coverage. Another good example of above and beyond in the effort. Employee engagement is about capturing your employees' heads and their hearts. Make them want to do for the company. And now here's some numbers to back this up. Highly engaged employees are 480% more committed to making your company succeed. That's worth the emphasis there, too. Highly engaged employees are 250% more likely to recommend improvements. Did y'all remember back in the day, and you may have heard this story, there was the Hilton Hotels was one of the first hotel chains to ever go up. We used to have motels. They were all flat. And you just drove up around in different things. But then they started to go to the high rises. And the people were complaining, their customers were complaining that the wait for the elevator was way too long.
And they were to get up to the 10th floor, or the 15th floor, what have you. And so they brought in a team of engineers to study the problem and how were they going to retrofit this elevator to go from the bottom floor to the top floor very, very fast. And then they got the best idea from one of their employees who was the janitor. And he said, don't do all that, just put some mirrors up. And the complaints dropped to zero. So you never know what you might be able to come up with. And now that I've said that, take note that in many high-rise buildings, you will see mirrors or reflective surfaces so that people can preen and primp around. Innovation comes from the strangest places. So what happens when your employees are not engaged? Employees leave. Well, what does that cost? They estimate it to be around 213% of the separated person's annual salary. Wow, you're paying double the amount to have someone leave. That is truly a big hit to your bottom line. These are just some of the tangible things that you can do. Loss of productivity, overtime, knowledge, skills, new hire costs, advertising. It's huge. It's worth it to make the effort to get your employees engaged in your business. What causes employees to be disengaged? Most of the time, it's us. It's the managers. And disengaged managers are 3 times more likely to have disengaged employees. Bad managers are creating active disengagement, costing the U.S. alone an estimated $450 billion. Have you known someone? Has anybody ever had someone leave because of a manager? Did you leave a job because of a bad manager? Absolutely. I think we've all done it. And this was interesting, I thought, when I came across it. 35% of U.S. workers said they would willingly forego a substantial pay raise to see their direct supervisor fired. I know y'all are out there dreaming. And so this is a typical and common scenario about what your workplace looks like. 7 out of your 10 employees are disengaged or actively disengaged. And one of my specialties as a human resources professional is to try to coach these other 7% to either get on board or let's let evolution take its place, okay? But we give them the opportunity to do that by coaching. Punishment, thing of the past. Coaching, that's the way to go. And if later on today you'll have the opportunity and I'll be happy to speak with you about that. And leaders are now starting to pay attention. And if you haven't paid attention now, it's time you start. You've heard the adage, one bad apple really does spoil the whole bunch. It really, truly does. One disengaged employee or negative employee will take down your workforce. You are only as strong as your weakest link. And another way of saying employee engagement is ownership. When someone feels an attachment and a connection with the company and the goal and they're informed, they're going to go that extra mile for you and they want to do their job well. Okay? How do you do it? How do you get it? Get trust in management. That's the easiest way is to get them to trust all of your managers. And I've got to power through this, don't I, Rush?
Yes.
Okay. some ways to do this is you must care about your employees, have integrity, and demonstrate competence. You've got to follow a leader. And another thing, train your supervisors. Expect and cultivate your supervisors to engage their employees as well. This has to be from the lowest person to the top person, just like we saw with that Google picture. And that we fail at this miserably. If you're sitting behind a desk and you haven't been out pressing hands with your workforce, you need to do that. You cannot accomplish everything, all of your business goals, by sitting by through email or a voicemail. You've got to communicate. And one more time, do that. It's not just what you do, it's why you do it. And so just to obtain engagement, remember these four things. And in the full presentation that'll be on your all's website, it'll talk a little bit more about that. And we have input, get input from your employees, involve them, interact, and improve. You can't do it alone as managers. You need help. Organize teams and get their input, involve your employees, interact with them, get feedback, and improve your business. And I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sherry. Okay, now that you know completely about being an expert of how to engage your employees, we're going to tell you how to save them in a disaster. How's that? Just in case you might need them. Mr. Edwin Myrick, Director of Emergency Management. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Emergency managers are often considered as doomsday preppers, right? We're not happy unless we're declaring an emergency somewhere for something. In actuality, we are planners who also specialize in relationships, such as your business does. Emergency managers find ways to mitigate any potential threat to our surroundings. That same concept should be adopted by the business community if they want to survive after a disaster. But what do you plan for? What do you consider outrageous? What do you believe will never happen in your business? Every business is different with different needs, just as every county is different for emergency managers. Maybe your business was on this corner and now you need a complete facility to make sure your profit doesn't stop. Maybe you had an office in this building and you just need to move some things around. Maybe the disaster is so big that it brings a country to its knees. What is it about us that makes us stop when the problem is so big, so large? They were doing a documentary not too long ago about a dam that was failing, and the community that was 15 miles away was just frantic. What are we gonna do? What are we gonna do? The one 10 miles away wasn't so bad, and the community right up underneath it could care less. It was just a simple another day for them. The problem was so large, they just shut down. They did not know how to accomplish that task. What do we need to do? There was a complete uproot for them. They had to move families, their houses, everything. So how did they do it? They didn't plan for it. ...70% of all businesses that lose communications during a disaster, after a disaster, go out of business within 18 months. Is that one of yours? Are you prepared? Business continuity 101. Does your business have it? Think of your planning needs as a construction project. You can't build a house unless you first pour the foundation. Do one plan at a time. When I took over in emergency management for Effingham County, we had absolutely no plans whatsoever. And the people that were my bosses didn't understand emergency management at all. I could not go to them with the entire plan and say, this is what we need to make sure that not only our citizens are safe, but our government continues working in the event of whatever it may be. And that's where we get our doomsday preppers, is that whatever it may be. That could never happen here. Storm surge in Effingham County, really? Come on. That can't happen. We're not coast. Wrong. A Cat 5, mind you, a Cat 5, puts Effingham County under 26 feet of water, the southern tip. That's a lot. But you would never know it. So if you think of that, if it puts the southern tip of Effingham County at 26 feet underwater, what about Chatham? Where's your business located? What threats do you have? Business continuity, emergency operations plan, alternate facilities, communications plan, transportation plans. What do you need for your particular business? Six Flags Over Texas. Media nightmare. How's your corporate responsibility? Are you involved? YMCA, United Way, things like that to get your name out there. Century 16, never saw it coming. Rush and I have done many business continuity presentations, as well as preserving human capital presentations. Our last one was to Mitsubishi Corporation, lasted 2 days. We covered four classes and reached about 500 people. And it covered things like this here, preserving human capital. This is just part of, if you think it can't happen, it can. What can't happen to yours? Maybe a car bomb? Already happened. City of Dalton, car bomb. Employee was mad. Why? Supervisor. What's one thing we can't live without? Everything else we can live without. If your business is without water, you leave. Period. West Virginia didn't see it coming at all. How could they? And it contaminated the entire aquifer up there. And this is what many of the businesses had. Do not use until further notice. And that covered all of them. Isn't my presentation upbeat? So start with a business continuity plan and a communications plan. The communication plan is key. It can be very expensive if you're not willing to open your mind up a little bit. If you look at Code Red, that's one particular company that offers some type of communications plan. As you see at the bottom here, it says SMX Text Alerts. This is for Effingham County. SMX Text Alerts, you pick up your phone, you text, follow space Effingham EMA to 40404. And that links you with every single alert text that I would send out for whatever reason. I can reach my entire population of 53,000 people for absolutely zero cost by using this particular program. Now that's where people perk up. Absolutely free. All right, so this is where people shut down. It's Twitter. Twitter is the devil. Nobody likes Twitter unless you have Twitter. We don't understand Twitter. I have recommended this to a number of companies. Lineage Logistics within Effingham County. How do we reach our people? If there is a disaster here, if there is a problem at the plant, we don't want our employees and our employees' families coming to the plant, because that's where our first responders are going to be. That's where we're going to be landing helicopters. So where do we put them? You should have a facility off-site, or you should have a staging area off-site that they would meet. But how do they know? That's an option. You can go on. I can go on to Twitter and create a Twitter account for Effingham County administrative staff, and those staff can log in to that particular one and get alerts to their phones. Hey, company picnic this Saturday. Hope to see you there. I'm sorry, we had an anhydrous spill. You do not need to come to the office, and we will be meeting at the Lowe's parking lot or Home Depot parking lot or wherever. Communications is key. Once those plans are completed, exercise them. Reach out to your emergency management personnel that's in your county. Talk with them. We are dying to bridge the gap, because not only are we come into businesses with plans that you can utilize for business continuity and things like that, but we're also bringing the knowledge of first responders. What to do? When SWAT comes through your door, will you know what to do, or are you going to get slammed to the ground? We did a full-scale exercise not too long ago. in Effingham County. It wasn't my last one, but it was the one before that, and it was preserving human capital, where SHRM was heavily involved in. It was an eye-opener for everyone that attended. Our last full-scale exercise, unfortunately, was a tanker explosion, and it was a real-life event. Y'all remember Dixie Crystals? If they had not had a business continuity plan, they would be out of business. Now we can all smile. I believe we have a board later that we can ask any questions that y'all might need. Rush.
We are happy to answer those questions for you. The Society of Human Resource Management, our Lowcountry area, does participate greatly in these business continuity plans. What we're talking about when we say preserving human capital, that's a nice way of saying that's an active shooter piece. We actually do soft guns in the whole nine yards. We put corporate people through it so they know what it's like and what the responses are like. But we have all those programs, and they're available to you. And again, we'll talk to you about them at the roundtable later if you're interested. Our next presenter, Mr. Wade Herring. Wade is an attorney. Everybody go, yay!
Yay!
He is talking about the great acronyms of human resources, ADA, FMLA, and a fun thing called workers' compensation. You all love workers' comp, don't you? You have a handout on your table, and there is a grid, and I'm turning it over to Mr. Herring.
All right, good morning, and let me extend my welcome to you to the city of Savannah. We are the hostess city of the South. That is how we take your dollars and make them our dollars. And we are glad for you to be here. And you're here also in a very calm week, the weekend before St. Patrick's Day. If you've not noticed, this is a big, big time in the city of Savannah, so it's a fun time to be here. Let me quickly talk about...
About second to the Georgia Bulldogs opening, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Y'all Bulldog fans in here, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So let me talk about workers' comp and as it interplays with the ADA and the FMLA. The frustration that I hear from clients and from businesses about workers' comp is not that good employee who got injured on the job and now has a claim. That's not the frustration I hear. The frustration I hear is the employee who, quite frankly, should have been terminated previously and now has a claim of possible merit, possible lack of merit. So the issue becomes not so much the comp claim, the issue becomes how you manage your workforce before you get the comp claim. And this is not a presentation on hiring or on discipline, but let me give you this takeaway. Most companies hire fast and fire slow. I would recommend that you hire slow and fire fast. In the words of Good to Great, be rigorous, not ruthless, but if you've got an employee who is not working out, you need to get rid of that employee. Now, the nervous HR person or the nervous manager will say to me, but Wade, what if they file a claim? And my response to that is, if this is the kind of person who is going to file a claim, what difference does it make if they file the claim today or they file the claim 9 months from now? Either way, you're going to have to deal with the claim. Let's be smart about this. Let's handle it the right way. Let's do the right kind of paperwork and counseling that we need to do. But if this employee is not in the right seat in the right company, let's get rid of this employee. It's too much trouble. It's too much time. It's too much expense. It's too much aggravation. Things you don't have to spend all of that precious resource on an employee who is not the right employee. So that's the frustration I hear about comp claims. It's not the good employee. It's that employee that, quite frankly, you didn't have the guts to do what you should have done before the injury took place. Now, what are some proactive things that you can do to manage your comp claims? Number one, in terms of your panel of physicians, that needs to be reviewed periodically to make sure that you've got physicians who are willing to work with you as the employer and who are willing to take the time to do the assessments that they need to do. Physicians are under a lot of time pressure themselves now. You need to make sure that your panel is a panel that is the right panel for you and your industry, and that those physicians on your panel are still willing to handle these kinds of claims. And there's some physicians who are pro-employee, and there's some physicians who are pro-employer, and obviously you want the pro-employer physicians. Most states, you can do drug testing. That's become almost sort of standard operating procedure. And as part of your drug testing policy, you should have as part of that policy that if there is an incident, not necessarily an accident, but an incident that results in the loss of work time, that results in property damage, that results in medical treatment, that's how you define incident, that you can drug test after that incident. And if that employee tests positive, in many states, that will defeat the comp claim. The other thing that many companies aren't doing, and I don't know why the word hasn't gotten out, but if you are an FMLA employer, and that's 50 or more employees, you need to run your FMLA time at the same time as the comp absence. And a lot of smaller companies that I come across for some reason think that FMLA cannot be run at the same time as the comp absence. That is not true. And you need to have that in your policy, and you need to apply the FMLA time so that 12-week clock is ticking while that person is out on comp. What happens if the employee says, I don't want it to be designated FMLA? It is not the employee's choice. If they qualify for FMLA, if they meet the definition, and if they're not coming to work because of an injury, they meet the definition, you need to run the FMLA clock, you need to give them the notice, and you need to let that clock run. So that, and then the final thing on comp is you can't just turn it over to the comp carrier and expect the comp carrier to manage the claim the same way that you would. Somebody in your company has got to be the liaison with that comp manager. Someone in your company has got to keep up the communication, because the comp carrier, let's face it, what are they trying to do? They're trying to minimize costs and get the thing settled. That may or may not be the right thing for you at the time. But you can't just turn it over to the comp manager and then complain when the comp company, the comp carrier, handles it in a way that you don't approve. You've got to stay on top of those claims, and that has to be on somebody's to-do list, somebody's responsibility list. It tends to fall through the cracks. Let me switch gears and talk a little bit about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It applies to any company with 15 or more employees. It was enacted in 1991, and it was greatly enhanced in 2008. I make that point on purpose because the president in 1991 was who? The first George Bush. The president in 2008 was who? The second George Bush. Equal employment discrimination laws, these are all federal laws that apply in all 50 states, are here to stay. They are not going away. Every now and then you hear somebody say, maybe on Fox News, somebody will say, if only we got the right person in power or the right party in power, these so-called unfriendly business laws and regulations would go away. They're not going away. There is a difference in enforcement priority, that is true, but these laws are not going away. So ADA passed in 1991, strengthened in 2008 by the Congress. Why was it strengthened? Because over the 1990s, the Supreme Court of the United States, through a series of opinions, weakened the ADA to the point where, quite frankly, it did not mean very much. And some of you may have been to an HR seminar toward the end of the 90s and even heard somebody say, yes, ADA is still on the books, but it's not so important as it used to be. After the 2008 amendments, it is important again. And let's think about what's going on with ADA and our workforce, the real impact of ADA is not on those persons who have been considered traditionally handicapped and excluded from the workforce. That was the intent, was to get those people into the workforce. That it has not worked that way. The real impact of the ADA is on your current workforce. Think about your current workforce. Who's still the biggest group, demographic group in the workforce? The baby boomers. I'm a young one at age 55. We're not going anywhere. We can't. One, we can't afford to. The economy has not cooperated with our retirement plans, and our adult children continue to suck the lifeblood out of us. Always gets a laugh because it's true. And the second reason we're not going anywhere is because we don't want to. The idea of retirement being a gold watch and you get to follow your spouse around the kitchen and do some yard work and play some golf, extremely unappealing to most of us, younger baby boomers especially. So what's going to happen, though, in this aging workforce? Well, you just fall apart. And so that's what you're going to be dealing with over the next 15 to 20 years. I'm not going to talk about the Age Act, but the Age Act also plays a part. And that's how I'm going to go out at the end of my career, is I'm going to have companies hire me to defend them from disability claims and age claims, and they're going to show that they didn't discriminate against because of age, because they hired the old guy to represent them. Disability, I wish I could give you bright line tests for what is and is not a disability. I can't. It's an impairment, physical or mental, that substantially limits a major life activity. It's a very fact-based analysis. It's a case-by-case analysis. It's not a label. Someone who has a label might be disabled and they might not be. Someone who has diabetes might be disabled and they might not be. Someone who has chronic back pain might be disabled and they might not be. So you're going to have to do fact-intensive, case-by-case analyses. You're going to have to get the medical care provider involved, and you're going to have to see if this person can do the job or not. The goal of the ADA is to put the person to work. When people start talking about ADA as a leave law, which it can impact leave, but the idea of ADA is to put people to work. And then how does that dovetail with FMLA? FMLA is a leave law. FMLA is a 12-week leave law. 50 or more employees, but that's about letting people be away from work. Can you offer light duty for FMLA? Yes, but you cannot require it for FMLA purposes. For workers' comp and ADA, is light duty a possibility? Yes, but be careful. Are you establishing a precedent now that you're modifying jobs in such a way that the next person who comes along also may want light duty? So I quite frankly think light duty has been overused. The reason it's been overused is because the comp people want to keep that person on the job to try to manage the claim. I'm not sure that's quite frankly so effective. So when you've got the comp claim, you've got to look at, do I also have an ADA issue? Do I also have an FMLA issue? And how do those things interact? One final point about FMLA. Once the 12 weeks is up, people have said, that's it. I don't have to do anything more with this person. Maybe not the case, because now we have ADA to contend with. So if they come back at the end of the 12 weeks and say, I can't come back to work tomorrow, but I can come back to work a week from now, I think under ADA, you've got to accommodate that additional week. If at the end of FMLA, they come back and say, I can't come back to work tomorrow, and I don't know when I can come back to work, that kind of open-ended, indefinite response, I do not believe you have to accommodate that, and then you could terminate. One final point on insurance. I see companies that allow employees leave for long periods of time, trying to do the right thing, right? Much longer than the 12 weeks, and they keep the employee on the group health plan. There is a problem with that, and the next presenters can speak to that perhaps better than I can, But the problem is this, in almost any group health plan, the definition of eligible employee is that you are actively employed. If the during the 12 weeks or then 1 or 2 weeks after that, that's not going to be an issue because that's covered by FMLA and ADA. But if you're into the fourth month, the fifth month, and I see this happen again where smaller companies are trying to do the right thing by a longtime employee who's been out for a catastrophic illness or injury, and they keep them on the group health plan for an extended period of time, what I'm seeing happen is the group health care comes back and denies the claim and says they didn't meet the eligibility test, and if it went on long enough, you're past the COBRA period. So the point is, with those leaves, you've got to be more proactive on the front end and perhaps go ahead and get that employee off your rolls. Thank you.
Thank you, Wade. All right, our final presentation section for this. There is a handout on your table that says the top things you need to know about Affordable Care Act, employee benefit plans, ERISA, and fiduciary liability. Miss Rebecca Shapansky, she's also an attorney, folks. All right?
I apologize.
That's okay. We like her. We do like her. She gets me through a lot of things. She's also accompanied by financial advisor Ginny Nichols, and I'm turning it over to them.
All right, everybody. Are you still awake? Good. We started this with employee engagement, so I'm very happy to see that we have still attendee engagement. With all due respect and apologies to my co-presenters, one of my favorite sayings has always been, we have met the enemy and he is PowerPoint. On that note, Jimmy and I have chosen not to have slides. Instead, what we have given you is a handout that is way more detailed than the number of things that we can possibly cover in this 15-minute period. We want you to use that as a resource to perhaps spark some questions that you can come up and afterwards ask us at the round table this afternoon. One of the most important things that I want you to keep in mind here is that conveniently we have scheduled our piece of this presentation just before lunch. And I say conveniently because it is the portion of the presentation that may be most likely to cause you all heartburn. And that is for a couple of reasons. And the standpoint of legal issues, like many of the things that we've been talking about earlier in this presentation, as part of your meeting here today, in the employee benefits arena, you have to keep both the government and your employees happy. And on the heading that no good deed ever goes unpunished when you have employees, there are a couple things specifically about ERISA that make it in some ways almost more scary than certain other areas of law. The first, I understand that you can't hear me, which is really not a common thing for people to complain about with me. The first and most important thing is that in certain of these areas, particularly the fiduciary issues that Ginny's going to be speaking to, it is not just your company assets at risk. It is your personal savings. It is your house. It is your car. It is your adult children's college funds that could potentially be at risk. These are things that may well keep you up at night if you don't pay attention to them. And the second thing is that plaintiff's attorneys, I am here to tell you, they have discovered ERISA. And the reason they've discovered it is because if they sue you and they are successful, they can make you not only pay the claim, but the attorney fees for the plaintiff employees. So these are big deals. These can, in some cases, be bet the company litigation. In the Affordable Care Act section of this presentation, the first thing I would have to say is that these presentations are hot off the presses yesterday, and in some respects are probably already outdated. The government has spent the last month already issuing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of regulations on all of this. Some of the most important things are we now have the final employer shared responsibility requirements that are in there. And the first of that is that there are some surprises in there. There's some additional ways that you can delay compliance and so on as employers, particularly as employers of 50 to 99. But those transition relief things are conditioned on not making changes to the aggregate number that you of hours that you're employing people, to the number of employees that you might have, all of those things. So there are conditions on those transition relief. The second is what they call the 90-day maximum waiting period, which means you can't keep somebody out of coverage for more than 90 days on your group health plan.
Now, keep in mind that this is applied if you happen to have a group health plan, even if you are not a so-called large employer who's required to have one. You still have to comply with most of these rules, most of these health reform kinds of rules. That 90-day period may not work the way you think it does. The 90-day period only begins to run after your employees are already eligible for the health plan. And there are conditions that you can put in place to say you have to work so many months before you become eligible to plan, then the 90 days begins to run. You can have up to 1,200 hours of consecutive. But the thing to keep in mind is that all of these are optional eligibility conditions and have to be in your plan documents and the materials that you hand out to your employees, or they won't be applicable. I don't even have a copy of the presentation in front of me here.
Oh, I wondered about that. There you go.
Talking from memory here. The third thing, many of you last year may have had something called cafeteria plans, where you said, especially if you're a small employer, oh, well, we'll just have them get their individual insurance and we'll let them run it through the cafeteria plan and give them a benefit from our employees so they can do this on a tax-deferred basis or tax-free basis. That's strictly limited now and may not even be available anymore. And if you still make it available and the government disagrees with how you've gone about doing it, you could be eligible or subject to pay excise taxes of up to $100 a day per affected person. So $36,500 a year for each of your employees is the potential excise tax. Now, the thing to keep in mind when you're looking at excise taxes and corrections and everything else and trying to comply with this, putting your head in the sand and pretending that none of this is going to matter, nobody's going to come after me, or even more importantly, I can rely on my carriers, my brokers, the people who are trying to sell me the ways to comply with this, is not necessarily the best way to go about this, because there are limited time periods within which you can fix some of these problems and get away without paying the taxes and without paying the penalties. But if you bury your head in the sand or you rely on people whose interests may not necessarily be aligned with yours as the business owner, then you may be the person who's on the hook for paying all of these fines, fees, and penalties and not even, you know, realize that they're out there. Lose your window of chance to actually fix them. Last thing I just wanted to mention very quickly, audits. This section, we're from the government and we're here to help, but just not necessarily you. And I mention them because it's not just the kinds of audits that you're going to be seeing in the Affordable Care Act, which is if a single one of your employees files and gets a credit for buying individual insurance on one of these exchanges, you will eventually hear from the IRS. It might be next year, it might be 2 years from now, even if that employee then later files a tax return and says, I actually wasn't eligible for it and I had to repay part of it. You need to have your documentation in place. You need to be able to defend and say exactly why you did everything on all of this. So, final thought on this particular issue. If you have a broker or a provider or a third-party administrator or somebody who's coming to you and saying, I have a great way for you to get around the requirements of this law, the fact is you're going to be the one that's on the hook if the IRS or the Department of Labor or the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services disagree with that. You're going to be the ones who are paying for this. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Moving into the second piece of this, we've called it the employee benefit plans because pieces of this actually sort of merge between healthcare plans, welfare plans, retirement plans. Very briefly on the first one, executive deferred compensation. Many of you may have these plans, many of you may not. The important piece to keep away is it's getting harder and harder to defer taxation on these things. And the rules are getting more and more complicated, so it's a course that you're going to have to chart very carefully. It is no longer enough, as a general rule, to just say it's unfunded, meaning, well, the creditors can get to it. That's no longer enough in order to prevent your taxation. And this is yet another one of those areas where you have a very limited time period to fix any problems that you might have, and that may already have passed in many cases. I'm going to defer the boomerang employees question for just a moment. Third point here, the courts might be able to rewrite your plans if you don't do it right the first time. This is still an evolving area of litigation. We had a United States Supreme Court case last year where people were saying, it went all the way up and they said, what happens if we have the summary plan description or certificate that we hand out to everybody, and there's a conflict between what that says and what the insurance policy says or our plan document says? Everybody thought they breathed a sigh of relief when the Supreme Court said, oh good, the plan document controls, even if we make a mistake in what we hand out to the employees. Keep in mind, that is only if there is a conflict. If you have something in the plan document or the insurance policy that's not handed out to employees, so there's just a gap in what's not disclosed, you could be on the hook as the employers for paying, one of my favorite examples, for somebody who was shot in the course of committing a felony. An exclusion that was in the insurance policy but was not in the certificate handed out to the employees, and the employee sued and won, and the employer had to pay for it. Last piece here, costs a whole lot more to fix problems in this area than it does to prevent them. So I want to talk just a little bit, now we'll go back to the boomerang employees issue, because this is one that comes up again and again and again, as Jenny will tell you. What happens and how do I handle it when somebody leaves and comes back? Those rules are way beyond the scope of what we can discuss here, but we wanted to make sure that you're aware there are very specific requirements for when you have to let them back onto your plans and what rules you have to apply to them. So in the concept of trying to work smarter and not harder in this particular area, I also work with, and my clients as employers work with teams. One team member is Jenny Nichols.
Hello.
So take it away.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Rush, what was that high sign? How much time do I have?
About 5 minutes.
Yay. To cover fiduciary responsibility. Yay. Good afternoon. It's almost afternoon and everybody's hungry, right? Yes?
Maybe not anymore.
Okay, I'm going to try and make this brief. I think that all of you know that it seems like these four other panelists are very passionate about what they do. Could we all agree? Yeah? Okay. Well, I am too about what I do, just much like you are about what you do. What we have is 15 minutes to go through what our topic is. That's impossible. Much like it's probably impossible for you guys to tell me about how to make lumber. Okay? You can't do it. However, what we are here to do is to be a resource for you today, and we are going to be here at 3 o'clock, so you're going to have questions. I obviously don't have enough time to go over everything. However, I do want to ask a couple things because I have, what, now 3 minutes? Okay. I want to ask everybody in this room, because I did a little research on your industry and a couple of you folks that are part of the association here. How many of you are key people in your company? Raise hand. That you make the final decision, you pull the trigger. Okay. How many of you sign off on documents for your retirement plan, your health plan? Anybody? Okay. With that said, how many of you are the person in HR or management that actually instructs people about their benefits? Anybody? There's a few of you. Okay. If you sign a document of any kind for a distribution request off of a retirement plan, anybody in here can do that? Who can do that? Okay. If you make a decision about the investments in your plan, if you sign off on a document for the plan, if you are on a committee that decides what investments you make, guess what? You're a fiduciary. Okay? Does everybody understand that? A lot of people don't understand the fiduciary capabilities here. What is actually out there? What are you actually liable for? Okay? I can't go through all of that right now, but Rebecca's right. You can lose your house. People think that the fidelity bond that is on your retirement plan that is required by law, that's 10% of your assets, and there, all these points are in here, or a few of them, plus I have some extra stuff for you guys at 3 o'clock if you want it, but that 10% fidelity bond does not cover errors and omissions. Okay, you have to buy PNC insurance to do that. Does everybody follow me on that?
And I would follow up with saying your general P&C, your general liability, isn't going to cover this kind of stuff. You need special ERISA administrative riders, special ERISA fiduciary riders. This kind of coverage is usually excluded or very strictly limited in your general P&C insurance.
Okay, with all that said, have I scared you? Okay, I really am not here to try and scare you. What you are, as business owners, as entrepreneurs, and from my research, it looks like most of the lumber companies that I've come across actually have a lot of passion about what they do. Am I right?
Oh,
they
on,
have, I can't hear you. They have heritage. They're living up to a heritage that started before them. And they are continuing that legacy. It is a family business most of the time. We get real home and chummy with our staff as entrepreneurs. Now, by the way, I am a financial consultant for the investment plans, but I also consult entrepreneurs in their businesses and how to design plans for their staff. So you look at behavioral issues, as Sherry has talked about. You look at pissed off employees, like Ed has talked about, and believe me, we all have them, okay? So where are your liabilities? It just takes one person to raise a red flag, okay? It just takes one. It could be, my investment did not get in on time. Or it could be that they did not deposit my contribution. The IRS may have a red flag of one little thing, that fidelity bond. If it's not filed on your 5500, guess what? You may get audited by the Department of Labor. That's just one little thing. But what can hurt you the most is a pissed off employee because you didn't design it right or you didn't follow up. So I'm going to give you one nugget today because I don't have time to tell you all about fiduciary responsibility, okay? Thank God, right? Okay, so I want you to write this down if you got a little piece of paper. I'm sure that you'll be able to remember it. I call this the DIDO process. D-I-D-O. No matter what you're going to do with your company, whether you're expanding, you're deciding on a vendor of who's going to haul your wood, whether you buy the equipment that's going to haul that wood, a tractor or a chassis or a trailer or whatever it is, or if you're going to expand your business, you're going to diversify your business, you have to follow a process. Am I right? A strategic process. It is no different in retirement plans, health benefit plans, emergency response, any of these things. It's ditto. First one's due diligence. Do your research. Yes? We have to do research, right? Figure out what are your options. In the retirement arena, you're going to want to do an RFP. Everybody know what an RFP is? Request for proposal. You can either hire a consultant to do that, or you can do it yourself. Your HR department, if you have a big company, now with a family-sized company, some people can't do that, okay? But if you are a larger company, usually your HR department will handle that, okay? Due diligence. I, implement your strategy. Implement your strategy. D, document it. Keep all your documents and document it. Under a fiduciary standpoint, much different, no different than anything else you're going to do, you're going to see what you're doing. You're going to document those files, whether it's a DOL response, whether it's, you know, what the tractors are hauling on, how much outcomes you have, how much product you're selling, whatever it is, or what equipment you're going to buy and how much it can produce for you. So you want to document it. You also want your safety precautions documented, no matter what it is. For retirement, you're going to have, hopefully, quarterly meetings discussing your retirement plan and documenting it in your board meeting minutes. you're going to want to have an annual, hear me on this, an annual review of your investment policy statement. It is compliance. If you do not, you do not know what investments you have. And believe me, the DOL doesn't care if you are ignorant. Am I right?
The auditors love it if you're ignorant, because that just gives them lots of traction.
Right. So you want to document. Keep those documents. Keep those meeting minutes. Keep those reviews. Sign off on them. Review them. Use your financial advisor and talk to them about what these options really are, because a lot of people are making mistakes here. Okay, so we've got DID, right? We got due diligence, implement, and document. The last one is very important, which is that ongoing review, that annual review, that quarterly review, meeting with your vendors, talking with your employees, meeting with your HR representative, making sure that you are providing what you need to, and if there's complaints, that you are actually responding to them and keeping them where? In your document files, okay? Because believe me, if you're audited, they're going to look for those. So DIDO, can everybody remember that? Ditto, everything you do. Now, with the last thing that I say, I'm glad that you're here in Savannah on one of the most busiest weekends we ever have. A lot of drinking going on. I applaud you for what you do, and we appreciate it very much that you came here and that you asked us to come in. We will be here at 3 o'clock, all of us. To answer any questions that you may have, please review over this in your leisure time, and I hope it doesn't make you go to sleep, but we are here to help you as resources, and I'm going to turn it back over to Rush.
Well, our time is a little over, and we are ending. We thank you very, very much. I hope you enjoyed our panel and my amazing networking group that I have. I am so lucky to have these people. One more round of applause for them, please. And we're going to turn it back over. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you throughout the conference.
Rush, thank you. That was great. Great information. Thank you all for being here. They're all going to stay around for the afternoon. They're going to eat lunch with everybody. So if you have questions, confront them, ask them, and they will be back for the roundtable. Their roundtable will be right out here in the foyer. In the meantime, we've got to turn this room over in about a half hour for lunch. So if you want to go call the office, take a snooze for a half hour, go out and walk around the block, half hour we'll have this room ready for lunch, and we hope you all come back. We're going to start the session at 12:30 sharp. So we'll see you on a bit. 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 We'll see you on a bit.